RPG Lessons Learned. When the game is over, when your players are gone, that's when lessons are learned.
Hello, Brian.
Hey, Dusty. How's it going?
It's going really well. And who's this to my right?
I don't recognize him.
We haven't seen him in some time.
I'm back.
Hey, Mike.
How's it going, guys?
And it is good to have you back.
It's good to be back. Sorry for the interruptions there for the last couple of weeks.
No, I'll be honest, dude. You're lost. You missed some great episodes. The Tanner interviews were phenomenally fun. And then Brian and I talking about Mace 16 for two episodes was also phenomenally fun.
Which was convenient since you weren't there.
Yes, it was. But it's good to have you back.
Thank you.
So, welcome to RPG Lessons Learned. So, if you've never listened to us before, the premise of our show is listen to us talk about lessons we learn from our actual sessions so that you can learn from our experience. And today, we'll be talking about another game in our Pathfinder Beginner Box mini campaign. So, several sessions in to our Pathfinder campaign, we started focusing sessions on actual characters. We had a session about Kyra, Mike's cleric. We had a session about Mercial, which we discussed. That's Nathan's rogue. And then for this session, Brian, we focused on Ezrin. We focused on your wizard.
We sure did.
So the local wizard in Sandpoint, according to the Beginner Box set, is a gentleman named Ilsori Gandithus. And armed with little more than that knowledge and the name of his school, the Tarandarok Academy, I proceeded to run an entire session centered on Ilsori Gandithus' school of witchcraft and wizardry. So, Mike, this was kind of a dungeon crawl. We explored every floor, the classrooms, the dorms, the libraries, the labs, the cellar. We made sure all of it made sense and it all had a function to play. I was trying to make it really feel like a real tower, but you found it to be kind of a slog at the time. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, thinking back on it, I think a lot of what it was this is the first time in a while we had had a dungeon that was a multi-map dungeon. We had been on a real long streak of either playing Theater of the Mind or limited map. I think the game we did before this was the graveyard one for my character, and it was basically that single map of the graveyard. So I think this had been the first game in a while where we had multiple maps to explore with lots of movement, lots of locked doors, lots of nooks and crannies. And I think for me, that maybe slowed it down a little bit.
Brian, any thoughts?
I'll just echo what Mike said. The multi-map dungeon crawl is something that we had sort of fallen out of the habit of playing. And I think that, at least with me specifically, if I don't do something within a couple of games, I kind of get really rusty really quick. And I really become accustomed to Theater of the Mind. I really enjoy that. I think it more closely matches how I want to play. And yeah, I think having the multi-level dungeon sort of threw me for a loop.
So what lesson can I take away from this? Is it just that we're done with dungeon crawls? Is there a better way to do dungeon crawls? Like, and I'll be honest, I struggle with dungeon crawls as well. I struggle, as the GM, I struggle with, why does this dungeon structure exist? And what's the purpose of it? And that's why this tower that was functional, like the very bottom floor was a cellar. The first floor is a school where all the nobles' kids learn basically primary school stuff, like how to read. And then the further you go up, okay, there's dorms where he has actual apprentices and journeymen who are learning magic. And then you go further and further up into the wizard's sanctum. So for me, I can only get behind a dungeon crawl as DM when the dungeon makes sense to me. So that's why I struggle. I struggle with the idea of this labyrinth created by this wizard thousands of years ago to trap adventurers. If I was an adventurer, that'd be real easy. I'm not going there. Done.
Yeah.
I would rather kill goblins in the woods than explore death traps by a crazy wizard. So it just doesn't, the ecology of that just doesn't make any sense to me. The logic of that doesn't make any sense to me. So that's why I struggle. But I thought I had overcome that with this tower, but it's still boring.
And you know, I'm struggling to put my finger on why, because when I compare this adventure that just had the three or four stories laid out on a map compared to something like the Tomb of Horrors, that was like four sessions, like 4 hour and a half sessions, that did not feel like a slog Whereas this, that was one, I believe it was one session, maybe two and a half
one.
Hours.
It was just one session, yeah.
Yeah, for some reason, this felt like a slog. So maybe it's just something personally with our group that when we have that map laid out in front of us, you know, maybe it's something in my mind. It triggers like a Dragon Warrior thing. It's like, oh, every single tile on this map could potentially trigger something that I'm not expecting for.
Yeah, maybe we should take some responsibility as players as well, or at least at the very least I should. So this was an Ezrin-based adventure, and I probably could have done more to bring the group along in like the excitement of being in Ilsorai Gandithis's tower. For me, sometimes I am not as energetic a player as I probably could or should be. I probably should have done a better job of being enthusiastic or playing more enthusiastically. I think that being absent, not that I was literally absent, but being absent of the team and trying to raise the stakes or bring the team along, that I probably added to the fact that we may not have had as much fun.
So how do I fix that? What lesson can I write down from that? What takeaway do I have? Either about the fact that laying a map in front of you guys makes it like Dragon Warrior, where you want to look at every tile, or getting Ezrin more involved in Ezrin's game. What could I, as DM, have done differently?
Maybe if we're going to have a game focused on a specific player, focus on Mike. Because Mike is more inclined to really get into it.
So what you're saying is I have to carry you guys.
Yes.
Oh.
That's exactly what I'm
saying.
So
let me ask you something. So had I warned you, well we're kind of jumping ahead of ourselves. I'll tell you what, I want to come, it's really the dungeon crawl that I want this question and this piece of the conversation to focus on. And I don't know what to take away from it. So I guess it's just for me as GM to be aware, Mike, that when I put a map in front of you, you're going to want to go in every single room and search every single thing that you see on that map. And I was using these wonderful maps by a gentleman named Arknight. You can go to...
They were good maps, yeah.
I think it's Arknight. If you Google Arknight, A-R-C, and then Knight, K-N-I-G-H-T, you'll find these maps. They were... I got them as part of a Kickstarter. They're phenomenally good maps. They're very detailed. The rooms have furniture, things like that. So are you saying, Mike, that when I choose a map, I choose a bunch of maps to be this Wizard's Tower. I lay them down in front of you, and then boom, you're seeing beds and chests of drawers and furniture and tables with and desks. And are you saying that you feel compelled to search every bit of that?
I think there is a bit of that, right? And I think the other thing, when I see a map, I immediately begin to metagame of, okay, if I were someone creating a trap on this map, where would be the best place for the trap to be?
I do that.
Where would I put the monsters for maximum, you know, bottlenecks?
And unlike Mike, though, I don't have to explore every square on the map. I am more interested. It's like going to the grocery store. I want to get in and I want to get out. So I think maybe as a team and as a group, we don't always have the same things that we value. And maybe that's something that if we were more aligned in what's important to us, what our priorities are, maybe we might have more fun than something like that.
And I would say my gamer brain actively takes over. I know we've talked a little bit about gamer brain in the past, but I totally get into that scenario where, excuse me, I get into that scenario where I'm back in my Doom 2 days and my Wolfenstein days, and I'm pushing on every wall to find the secret entrance, you know, trying to dissect the adventure, trying to dissect the obstacles.
I think we could probably do a better job of collaborating. Not that we don't collaborate, I think that we do, but I think it's often that I'm sitting here looking at a tablet, Nathan is trying to figure out ways to, you know, he's going to crack a joke and maybe try to think of ways to game something. Chris is sort of doing his thing, probably checking ESPN and you know, cracking a joke, and Mike is like, guys, let's just go ahead and do this. I think we could probably come together a little better and agree on what we're going to do and not just say whatever Mike says, which is normally how we do it.
I agree with that.
All right. Well, let me ask one more question about the map. If I had hand-drawn the map, if we were on a vinyl mat and I was using wet erase markers and I'm drawing the map as we go, does that make it better or worse? Is it better because it's simpler and I'm not drawing furniture that distracts you? Or is it worse? Because if I do draw furniture, then, oh no, why did he draw that set of drawers?
I never thought about that.
I honestly don't know how to answer that now. I literally have a conflict in my brain where my left side of my brain absolutely says, oh no, if it's a simple hand-drawn map, you can just play it and you'll fill in the blanks with your mind. But no, my right side of the brain absolutely says, yeah, if you draw a chest on that map, it's a 99% chest that chest is trapped and it's going to kill me.
It's a mimic.
Yes, it's a mimic.
All right, so I don't know what to put here. We've talked before about the grid versus gridless, and we've all said that we like the grid.
Yeah, I like the grid.
We've all said that we like gridless, so I don't know what to take away here.
I don't know. It could have been.
How about this? You know what? I'm laying the maps down, and it's starting to feel like a slog. Can I just give you guys permission to say, yeah, this is kind of draggy, Dusty. Can you just, you know, let's fast forward to the next encounter? Like, does that feel okay to say? I think of it this way. Are you ever watching a movie for the first time? You've never seen this movie before, and it's kind of draggy, and you start hitting the 10-second skip button just to see when something's going to happen.
I don't do that.
I do that.
I don't do that.
I do that a lot.
I normally just disengage.
Yeah. That's when I normally pull out the phone. It's like, okay, when the music swells, I'll start watching again.
Okay.
But maybe it's not that we skip to the next encounter. Maybe it's that the next time we do a dungeon crawl, we start mapless, and then you only put a map down if we're struggling to engage with that dungeon. Because that would be the only real reason I could see we need a map, is if we need something to funnel us through a certain checkpoint or give us some certain clue that we're not glomming onto from the words.
Is that unfair to Dusty, though, to ask him to do all this prep and then not utilize the materials that he's prepping with?
Well, and too, ask my wife. I've spent hundreds of dollars on maps.
On these items, yeah.
Yes.
That's a good point, too.
Maybe it's the next time I put down a map, I say, hey, don't get too into the map. I'll make sure you don't miss anything.
Okay.
Or I'll make sure that if you miss anything, it's an honest that you missed a roll. Or that you missed something because the story demanded it, not because you didn't poke this wall.
That could work.
That's fair. I like that.
All right. I don't know how to write that down, so we're gonna keep moving in the interest of trying to hit our half-hour mark, which we never do. All right, on the other hand, so last thing with the map. On the other hand, I did work really hard on giving each floor and each room a purpose so that it felt like a complete, you know, building, a self-sufficient, functional building that had, you know, a reason to exist and people could conceivably live there. Right down to, I mean, some of the rooms upstairs, we had chamber pots in them. Like, we went there. We went into the logistics of how people actually live there. Was that good? Was that verisimilitude good? Or
I liked it. I liked that part.
I agree.
For me, what's so fun about D&D can be the mundane, and how do they deal with the mundane in this fantasy world?
I mean, so it's like any story, right? So any kind of narrative or any kind of fiction. So example. So right now on one of the other podcasts I'm doing a serialized story, and I've done two episodes so far. One episode was very sort of vague, didn't really anchor anything into reality. The second part, I'm really trying harder to, you know, have real points of reality, like landmarks, programs, just all these bits of life that people can relate to draw them into the story. If it's just, you know, well, you walk into a room, well, what's in the room? I don't know. You know, there's a bookcase over there in the corner, probably. I mean, so that doesn't create any sense of reality, and it doesn't draw people in. So I like the fact that there are chamber pots in this tower. I mean, it makes it real.
So, Brian, we touched on this a second ago, but since this was an Ezrin game, I left a lot of the initiative up to you. I left a lot of the story up to you. How was that?
So the way I've been playing the character, and basically as kind of like a screw up, smart guy, capable, but I mean, he's a sort of a disappointment in life. He's in his 50s and now he's a level 4 wizard, which, hey, level 4 is awesome. You know, like in the real world of gaming, if you're level 4, you were a tough dude, but you know, you're not as tough as say somebody who's a level 12 or a level 8. But you certainly stand above the rest of humanity. But in the story, I mean, so I think my character had big dreams of what he wanted to do, and he didn't realize them. So now he's just sort of kind of like a lovable screw up. And he's just sort of living his life the way that he is. So he's lacking a lot of ambition. And he's just recently found at this point, like, that he really does want to be a good wizard. He knows he's not going to be the best wizard. That's not in the cards for him. He's too old. He knows that this game is drawing soon to end. But he's trying to make good on at least the path that he's on. So with this, I mean, so the way I played it was that Ilsori Gandithis was somebody that he thought that he could connect with and look up to, and he kind of wanted a mentor in life, and this was an opportunity for him to do that. So it's kind of the way that I played it. I don't know that necessarily in and of itself is something that is going to something for the rest of the team to rally around. I think probably the way I could have played it in a way that the rest of the team would have been more motivated to make it up the tower, more so than just, you know, Ezrin. Ezrin has a man crush on this, you know, local powerful wizard. Again, I think it's one of those things where I think that I could do a better job just in general in playing my character, probably a little more straight and probably a little more in a way that makes them more heroic, where I'm mostly just trying to play them off like myself. I'm Mary Suing my wizard is basically what I'm doing.
You seem tired too coming into this game. Do you remember that? You seemed pretty exhausted personally.
I'm always a little bit exhausted, I think. So I don't remember specifically, but it's very likely. I literally, it's kind of like when I'm listening to an audiobook, I can tell you where I was when I was listening to a specific chapter. But when it comes to a game, I can't tell you a thing about what my life was like.
So, did I warn you that the session was going to be about you before you showed up?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I knew, yeah.
Okay.
Because we had already gone through the Mike game. I think we'd already had the Nathan game. I think I was probably third or fourth in the series of character specific stories.
Okay, so you knew. You had the warning coming in. All right. Is focusing in the future. In future. Should I continue focusing some sessions, not all sessions, on individual players? With Nathan's game, it worked out beautifully, as we said. Mike, with your game, it worked out pretty well. Yeah. With Brian's game, we struggled. We definitely struggled. Is this something I should continue?
I'll let you go, Mike. I just want to make this quick point. I'm all about you can focus on a character or a person in the game, but it doesn't have to be, and there doesn't have to be a fairness policy in place. If you have a game focusing on Mike, you don't have to have a game focusing on me next to balance things out.
I think that's a good way to approach it. Maybe each individual player gets an opt-in or an opt-out if they want a character-specific.
Or you don't even have to tell. Unless you need to tell us, you don't even necessarily even have to tell us.
So if I had given you the option to opt out, Brian, would you have opted out before this, or did you need this experience to know that it's not your thing?
I mean, like, even in the future, I mean, it could work out. Maybe if I had a different character. So if this was the game we were playing in 4th edition, I totally think I could have had a character.
Okay, got it. So yeah. It's more how connected to the backstory are you?
It's how connected to the backstory and what are the motivations for my character.
And you were struggling at that time anyway.
Yeah, I was just having a hard time. I was having a hard time bringing it all together with Ezrin.
Was this the game where, character-wise, you were being really hard on yourself and the entire party was like, no, no, you're a good wizard. Look at what you did. You did that. Was that this game or another game?
Yeah, it was either this game or after.
It was a couple games. It was this game and then also a few more.
Okay. I think that might have had something to do with it, too. I think we as characters might have gotten a little too slap-happy with that whole concept, and it kind of just turned the whole, we're focusing on this character. Oh, we're making a joke out of this character, which at the time was hilarious. But thinking back to the progression of the game and maybe some of the times that it slowed down, us, not Brian, but the other players at the table might have also been inhibiting that.
Did the game have enough variety? So, quick reminder, right? It was dungeon crawl. It was a lot of exploration, several social encounters, you know, talking to people about Ilsori and what he did. There were a lot of puzzles. There were the two statue puzzles. There was the actual physical wooden puzzle that I handed you to solve to open the final door.
I completely forgot about that.
Yep, there was combat. There were the dire rats in the basement. There was the evil cleric. So it definitely had combat. I was trying to throw every bit of variety I possibly could. The only thing this game didn't have was a skill challenge. It had everything else. Was it enough variety, or was it too wide and not deep enough?
I thought the variety was great. I think this is the most varied game we've played in a while, and it made a nice balance to the dungeon of having lots of different opportunities to explore and activities.
The only thing I think that didn't work that well, and I don't think it was the setup itself, I think it was our execution, was the voice activated lock, where we had to figure out
the two statues. Yes. Yeah, so we talked at the time at the table about how there were these, for those of you listening at home, the stairwell was guarded by statues, and you had to give the statue a password to get on this floor. Well, I had the two consecutive floors guarded by statues that needed different passwords, and that repetition was annoying. And I knew that as soon as we played it, as soon as we got the second statue, I was like, oh, this is annoying. But it happened, and I didn't see it coming, because as I'm putting together this tower in my mind, and as I'm putting together my notes for the tower, it's easy to make a decision like that sounds just like this. Hey, he can animate statues, and that's how he's going to defend the floors. So every floor should have a statue. So boom, it's this one decision you make, and all of a sudden there's multiple of the exact same puzzle on different floors. So that was an easy trap for me to fall into, was repetition, like too much repetition in the game. We should have glossed over the second statue. That's my fault entirely. Anything to add to that?
The first puzzle was I had to say, somebody had to basically speak as Ilsorai, like, I, Ilsorai Gandithus, command you to open, or something like that.
Well, the first one was you had to say you had permission from Ilsorai to be there. And the second one is you had to say you were Ilsorai.
I don't think that we worked it out in a way where we said we have permission to be there. I think, if I'm not mistaken, we basically said that we were Ilsorai, and I think that the statue let us through.
Yeah, I think I got tired of having you guess the riddle. So as soon as you landed on something that worked, you guys had worked out some logic for, oh, this is what we should do. Students are meant to get up here. Here's how this might work. Yeah, it's logical. So I just let it happen.
So I think we basically just repeated the same thing for both levels.
Yeah, probably. So again, I recognize that repetition was bad. I won't be doing that again.
I mean, it's just one of those things. I mean, how do you know until you do it? And it's going to be, there's so many lessons that we've learned, it's going to be hard to keep track.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, this was, the prep for this game was good. The verisimilitude was good. The variety was good. It just goes to show that no matter how experienced you are and how much work you put into it and thought you put into it and how much experience you apply to it, of knowing that people want variety and verisimilitude and reasons.
So
you can still screw up.
So when we post a podcast for this, the title of the episode should be the definition of verisimilitude.
Verisimilitude. I love that word.
I can't even say it, but I know what the word means.
The word. I first learned about that word from a wonderful featurette on the Superman DVD, where Richard Donner, apparently he had a banner printed up for verisimilitude. He's like, look, we're dealing with fantastical stuff in this movie, but I want people to treat it like it's normal. And I want to deal with it as if you saw this in real life, what would it be like? So the watchword for that movie that Donner had printed on a huge banner was verisimilitude. So I've loved that word ever since.
That's cool.
Anyway, all right, last question. So Brian, we ended the game on a bit of information about your father, who we cleverly named Tedzrin. So Ezrin's father is Tedzrin. It kind of fell flat.
Yeah.
Why didn't you grab that seed? Why didn't you care? Is it the same thing? Hey, I'm still exploring this character. I still don't know.
So had this been the second game that we played, I would have jumped all over it. But in playing this for so long, I've forgotten his backstory to the point where it doesn't even factor into the way that I think about the character. Yeah, Ezrin, his father was basically framed for something, and I don't even remember. So basically, his father was framed for a crime or something he didn't commit.
Yeah, he was framed for worshiping a demon, and then it turns out, according to the backstory in the beginner box, that turns out he wasn't framed. He really did.
Did I know that?
Yeah.
Dude, are you sure that I knew that part?
On the character sheet that you use every game, yeah, it's printed on the back of it.
Whoops.
Okay, so that goes to the point. I don't care what his backstory is. I don't play him that way.
So to play devil's advocate for Brian, I have no idea what my character's actual backstory is, other than she loves her god.
Yeah, we are going to definitely not use pregens on our next campaign, for sure. But you know what? Let me say this, too. I have been completely comfortable with you guys taking hold of the backstory is not canon. It's a suggestion.
Yeah.
If you want to get rid of it, I'm fine with that. If you want to do something different, I'm fine with that. So with Kyrat, I don't think the backstory's come into play. With Mercial, it really hasn't. Valeris has a totally different backstory. Chris is very much, he's done a great job of telling us what Valeris is back. He's like, yeah, I'm not going to do this thing on the back of the character sheet. Here's Valeris' actual backstory.
Yeah. So how long have we been playing this campaign now?
Almost 6 months.
So maybe if we do something that we're going to play for more than a couple of games, maybe we roll our characters and come up with them.
I think so.
My GMs hate it when I roll my own character, though.
All right, so the Tedrin thing fell flat. It's another shade of the same thing. You weren't ready for that seed.
I would have been ready many games earlier, but by that point, I just quit caring.
So it was almost too late for that seed.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, let's do a review of what we took down on the whiteboard here, and I'll throw in some stuff as we go. So the first thing is I did figure out a way to write down the thing about the maps. Players focus on visuals. And I've known that, but the conversation today confirms it, and it's easy to forget. It's easy to grab some maps, you know, a couple hours before your session and not look at them real close and think about, oh, what are the players? When I lay this down, the players are going to focus on it because it's the only thing in front of them about the game. So, of course, they're going to overthink it. It's part of the game. So players focus on visuals. As a DM, you need to be aware of that, mitigate that with statements about, hey, this is map isn't perfect, but I bought it a couple of years ago, and by God, I'm going to use it. So think about mitigating statements you can make to have the players focus less on the map or focus on the areas of the map that are important. That way they don't get their brains don't turn to mush as they try to process every single room of this map in huge detail. Is that fair?
Yes.
Yeah.
Next one. Only focus on players who are ready. And I'll even go a step further, Brian, and say players, characters who are ready, because you made a good point. When I think about Ken Blanchard's situational leadership, it's not the
SL2, situational leadership 2.
Situational leadership 2. When I think about Brian the player, it's tempting to say, well, Brian the player has been playing for years. Brian the player has played in really good games. Brian is an S4. Brian is...
Oh, I would not say. I go between an S2 and an S3.
But Brian is both motivated and competent, so I might assume he's an S4. But situational leadership teaches that Brian is never an S4.
Mm-hmm.
Brian at this particular task is an S4. It's not just Brian. It's what situation is Brian in. So with this Ezrin game, Brian...
I'm back to an S2 on certain aspects.
Yeah. Brian with... What was the paladin's name?
Malkior.
Brian with Malkior, complete S4. Understand your motivation, highly motivated, highly competent at playing that character, highly competent with the character sheet, very able to slip in that role. Brian with Ezrin, maybe an S2.
Yeah, that's fair.
Competent, but unmotivated.
Yeah, that is exactly that. Yeah, that's very fair. I situational leadership, for those of you out there who haven't taken it or explored it, I think makes a lot of sense. I would definitely look into that. It's a good way to understand how you... and people around you can be excellent at in one area and not so much in another, because people aren't excellent at everything. They're excellent at specific tasks.
Yeah, and it's a good that whole class is a good reminder of it.
Yeah.
So really only focus on players' characters who are ready to be focused on, and talk with players about their state of readiness. Next up, variety's good. So I threw a lot of variety into this adventure. I knew that I could emphasize things that were working and maybe gloss over things that weren't working, and I should have glossed over more, because the next point I wrote down is that close repetition is boring. I don't want to say that repetition is bad, right? Because some repetition is good. In fact, you could probably do a really great puzzle based on repetition with minor variations that really draw players into, oh, how is this room similar to the last room as far as mechanics go, but what's the trick to this room? Repetition could be really interesting, but close repetition, boring. Been there, done that, especially in the same session. So I went ahead and wrote down that close repetition is boring. Anything else to add on this game?
I think you've summarized it really well.
Yeah. Hey, always stuff to learn. Always lessons to learn, no matter how much you play.
So I do want to mention one thing. So this was a good reminder for us that rolling treasure was kind of painful.
Oh, yeah.
Once we got through it.
Yeah, there were quite a few things to roll. In fact, we should mention, because of this game and a few others, I actually made a treasure roller. We mentioned it quite a few episodes ago. If you go to dustinian.com, like dustinian.com, and you go to the gaming section, you will find a Pathfinder Beginner Box treasure roller where I codified the random treasure rolls from the Pathfinder Beginner Box. Every monster in the Beginner Box says, you know, for treasure, you know, one minor treasure, two minor treasures, one major treasure, three major treasures. So that page has two buttons, minor treasure, major treasure. And you push those buttons and it'll go through the whole generation process for you exactly as written in the book. And we've been using that for probably the last three or four sessions. Oh, what all the fun of random treasure. It hasn't removed any of the fun of random treasure.
Right.
I don't think.
No.
It's way better.
But it's removed the percentile dice and this table, and now let me go to that table and another die roll. It's just what a slug to spend the last, 10 minutes of your session rolling up treasure, when you could hit a button and still be like, ooh, a staff of healing. What are we going to do with that?
I think you made a good point in our most recent game that we haven't talked about yet, but in our most recent game of potentially rolling that treasure before the game to understand what items the NPCs have on them and they could potentially use in battle.
Yeah, so last game, just three nights ago.
Yep.
They killed a cleric, an evil cleric, who had a treasure on him, and when we rolled it, it was a wand of healing. And it's like, oh, wow, he could have used that on himself.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, Mike. I may do that. I may roll it ahead of time, but part of the magic of the random treasure is the rolling it at the table.
True.
So, I don't know. I'm still kind of on the fence about that. As in D&D, as in so many things, there is no one true path.
It's very true.
All right, I think that's it for our episode this week. Good lessons learned. A reminder that RPG Lessons Learned is part of the RFC family of shows, so please visit tfradio.net and explore all the other wonderful podcasts in Brian's podcasting repertoire. Thank you for listening. People call them postmortems, evaluations, appraisals, reviews, retrospectives. We call them lessons learned, and we're sharing ours with you.